So I think data for business is crucial, and data needs to play a central role in any business. When it comes to AI, I see it more as, what are you doing that could theoretically be scaled with the benefit of AI that also can survive the limitations of what AI is not going to be able to give you?
Welcome to It's Settled, the Ametros podcast. Each episode, we're going to dig into the humanity in workers' compensation and insurance claims, exploring the stories of injured people and those who support them, as well as the good work professionals are doing in the industry. And now, I invite you to join me, Sean Dean, General Counsel at Ametros and the host of It's Settled. Now, it's settled. Let's get on to the episode.
We are very excited today to have Solomon Khan with us. He's a founder and CEO at Delivery Layer, and also host of his own podcast called The Data That Drives Revenue Podcast. And we're super excited to have you here today, Solomon. Appreciate your time. This is, we were talking about a little bit about offline before that. This is our first big kind of crossover topic. And my certainly don't have the domain expertise in data and analytics and AI that you do. So I'm really looking forward to this because I know, having been in the insurance industry for 15 years, that in general, the insurance space and more specifically workers' compensation has been slow to adopt some certainly big data. I think we've seen things in recent years underwriting and certain predictive models kind of come into play, and maybe even some areas around customer service. But we're really excited to have you here, Solomon, so thank you so much for your time and for being here.
No problem. Excited to be here, Sean. Thanks for having me. And this is also my first, insurance industry podcast interview. So I'm excited on the other side.
Cool. So before I kind of start throwing questions at you and have you educate me and by extension our viewership, why don't you tell Solomon a little bit about your background? You know, start from the beginning, your educational background and your professional career background, and really what drew you to this area. And then I'm going to pepper you with questions because I'm super interested about this. It's like, if you Google generative AI or AI, put it into the Google machine, there's going to be 500 million news stories that come up. And we're seeing stuff about doomsday scenarios and this godfather of AI quitting Google and telling us all these existential threats. So I'd like to clear up a lot of that. I follow you closely on LinkedIn too, and you seem to be a really great source of truth and a sort of calming, if you will, around some of that stuff. So I'm looking forward to it. But why don't you tell us all about who you are and where you came from and how you got here?
Sure, no problem. So I went to school for operations research, which obviously has a lot of connection to the data world. But this was before the days of data science. And so when I graduated, there was no data science career to go into in the same way that there is now. So like a lot of people who went to school in New York and studied technical disciplines, I ended up in finance. So I was in finance for a couple of years and doing analysis work, but it was sort of financial analysis work at a company called Wall Street Access, which is a great experience. And I was there for a while, and it was a very entrepreneurial company. And so they were always building a lot of new things. And when I was there for a little while, what I realized was that the most interesting things that were probably going to get built in my lifetime were going to be more centered around tech than around, you know, the next hedge fund or the next mutual fund. And so I left my job. I taught myself programming. I went to go start a startup called Memoir Place that recorded a conversation between you and a relative and turned it into a memoir. And it could all be over the phone. It all happened in the back end. Interesting experience, terrible business. So it crashed and burned. And I decided to stay in technology. And so I was at a startup in New York. I was working as a programmer. And that was at the sort of dawn of data science when the HBR article came out. And they said, if only you could find someone who had a combination of statistics skills and programming skills and business skills, they could do this new cool job called a data scientist. And they could build these new cool things, and they could have sort of a technical but business focused role. And it was a great opportunity, but good luck finding those people, because who had randomly accumulated that odd assortment of skills? And I looked around and I said, hey, that was me. And my company was trying to figure out what to do with data. And I raised my hand and said, hey, why don't you let me run this thing? And they said, yes. And the rest is history. So I ran data at that startup called Paperless Post for a couple of years, built the team up. I went next to go to a consulting company called Bionic, which is now owned by Accenture. And while there, I helped really big companies think through how to build new data products. And then after that, I went to Nielsen, where I led product and analytics on the P&L of the Nielsen sports business, which is like data supporting sports sponsorship. Was at a startup company for a little bit in the, you know, e-commerce space, leading data there. And then most recently, I founded Delivery Layer. And what Delivery Layer does is it's sort of a external facing data application. So most of the tools in the world of data are built for internal decision-making support. But if you ever need to get your data to someone outside your business, it totally falls apart. Mm-hmm. And I imagine in the insurance business, there are a lot of Excel files getting emailed or FTP'd to each other all the time. And I imagine it gets kind of complicated because you've got multiple different providers who need different cuts of data from your database. You're relying on a lot of manual work or hacky engineering solutions. And so Delivery Layer is kind of custom built for that use case. You've got a web application where your customers can log in, see your data. You've got an API for if the data science team or the programming team at your external counterpart company wants to use that. And it's sort of a plug and play solution for what otherwise would take a lot of custom development.
Cool. And Solomon, you're 100% right about the reporting aspect. And a lot of times it's on the company who's generating that has the data and is generating the report, kind of guessing what the customer wants or needs. So it's not a conversation. It's just a one-way transaction. Hey, here you go. Here's a bunch of data. It's all over the place. I'd like to get into that with you, but the fanboy part of me who likes to eat up podcasts in my spare time and reads a lot, I just have a lot of questions for you. And I apologize in advance if these come across as like really pop culture type questions, but knowing that we're always late in the insurance industry and we're way behind the curve, the learning curve on this stuff, I think it'll be helpful for viewers to hear this stuff because we're all interested about it. And it's really difficult to tell like the veracity of the stuff you're getting from a blog or, you know, something in Wired magazine or not to disparage the, you know, any publication. When ChatGPT, I think it was 3.5, the one that you were able to get from OpenAI on your phone. I mean, when that came out and I was able to play with it and, you know, say like write a LinkedIn post about insurance in the style of William Shakespeare, and it did it in like a second, a light bulb went off in my mind and went, God, this is like almost frightening. If the amount of information, and I don't even have a grasp of like the data set that's behind ChatGPT, so I'd love for you to talk about that. But there's something there, and there's something beyond just a chatbot that could interface with a customer to answer a question. And then I downloaded the app, played with it, showed my wife and son at dinner, and they thought it was just silly. They thought it was like a parlor trick. And then within weeks, there were just article after article saying this is going to change everything. And then there were even some experts and maybe I'll use it in air quotes, but I don't know. I don't know who Jeffrey Hinton is. I guess he was at Google and they're calling him the Godfather AI. He stepped away and said, hey, we need to slow down with this stuff. And there were calls that this could be used for nefarious things, and that there was an actual like existential threat to the human species. And I'm going, oh my gosh, this seems way blown out of proportion. But I'm going to stop there with, so you know how a novice like myself comes at it, and I'm speaking with you, Solomon, as an expert. Maybe we even just step back and talk about like this large language model and what ChatGPT is and how it got here, and then talk maybe about some use cases, and then these calls for we need to slow down. It's going to go Terminator Cyberdyne on us and end us all.
Okay. Yes, let's do that. But that was a lot. Where should we start there?
Why don't you talk to the audience about ChatGPT, what it is, and where it is right now,
sure,
in current form.
Okay. So ChatGPT is what's called a large language model. So you might have seen LLM out there as an abbreviation that stands for a large language model. And what that does, and I'll give my sort of, in terms of my background, I've led business like the Nielsen business that I led product and analytics for, right? It was built on AI models. So I'm going to try to simplify things for the audience. And there's also some very deep technology innovations that AI companies around these deep learning models have done that I also could not tell you the specifics, but I will give you the general gist of what's happening.
Perfect. Thanks.
So in these large language models, what they do is they train on an enormous set of data of people using language, right? And in the case of OpenAI and other similar companies, what they've essentially done is they've scraped the internet, right? They've taken every conversation on Reddit. They've taken every conversation they can scrape off of various different platforms where people are talking to each other. They've taken articles, they've taken whatever they can get their hands on that people are writing on the internet. That's what they've taken. And then they've used those large language models. So these are models that are trained on enormous amounts of text data. And then they're using that to build a predictive model that will essentially predict the next word. And that's what's happening. And so there are some parameters that you can feed to these programs to help them predict sort of what the next word is. And there are ways for them to look at a paragraph and decide how might you change that paragraph. And then you're stitching those things together to provide sort of the ChatGPT experience, which is, I'm going to get an input. Write me a LinkedIn post in the style of William Shakespeare about the insurance industry.
Yep.
So in that enormous set of all of the conversations that they've trained on, they've got an idea of Shakespeare-ness, right? It's like, they can tell that when Shakespeare words are used, it's kind of like this. And then they've got this area of insurance over here. And then they've got this area of LinkedIn. LinkedIn posts generally kind of look like this. And insurance posts use these words. And Shakespeare uses this style. And then they kind of mash it all together to make predictions on what to say next. And that's how these models work. And that's why when you ask it a question, even though you might think, oh, how could it possibly answer a question like that? It's able to do that kind of response.
Oh, it's interesting. I appreciate that explanation. That makes sense to me, because when I think about AI, I think about the early days. I say early days, maybe going back a decade plus or minus a few years, when Google rolled out its search function, which seemed to me like it was like almost like ranking, like it was a little clunky as far as what word would come next, but you could tell it got better and better as more people searched. I remember seeing when Netflix came out with like, hey, you should watch this based upon your, you know, series of videos that you watch. So this just sounds like it's that on steroids, I guess. I mean, we're talking about a lot more data, and I'm sure the model behind it is way more sophisticated than just simple ranking.
Well, and that's really where the technical innovation has come in. It's that over the years, because these models have been theoretically possible for a very long time. Huh. It's just that they're very expensive. Because if you think about all of the ways that you would need to compute the, and essentially what's going on behind the scenes is you're training a mathematical equation. And training a mathematical equation on just a small amount of parameters is relatively reasonable. But if you think about how many parameters you would have to train in order to answer a question like LinkedIn post in the style of Shakespeare for the insurance industry, it gets to be enormous. And so the factor that's held people back the most has been cost. And what OpenAI did and what a lot of these companies have done is take advantage of innovations in GPU processing power. And so with GPUs, what they've been able to do is take these very complicated equations and run them in parallel on these powerful machines, and they've been able to spend billions of dollars in training these models. But because they were able to spend so much money, the amount of data that they were able to hold is now sufficient enough that it can answer the types of questions that you were asking with more detail. There's also a human element in a lot of these models where they use people who are looking at responses and generating whether that response was good or not, or answering specific questions to help sort of train the model or stop it. You know, a lot of the safety features in OpenAI, where if you ask it to do, how would I best do this illegal thing, it'll tell you that it can't answer you. And so a lot of those are trained by humans. So it's a massive effort on the cost side in order to train and take all of that data and get it into where you can consume it with a very simple, text input.
So moving from there, I mean, that explanation gives me a sense of like, okay, we're just talking about data and mathematics. Where is the leap from ChatGPT and data and mathematics to the world's going to end? Like, this is an existential threat to the human race. We got this Jeffrey Hinton, Godfather AI, quitting Google. We have all these high profile tech wizards signing these, open letters to the government to regulate this stuff and have a moratorium on continuing development of these large language models and slow things down. Like, what's the concern there? Because I can think of bad actors using it in a bad way, but I don't see it as necessarily an existential threat to the human race. Or is this being blown out of proportion? Like, what's your take on that, Solomon?
My personal take is that it is blown out of proportion. There is a theory in Silicon Valley that at some point AI is going to become smarter than people, but and it's going to become so much smarter than people so quickly that it would be able to destroy the human race with ease if it wanted to, because of how smart it got so quickly. I don't see that there's any reason to believe that would happen. It's impossible to prove true or false, because it's something someone has said about the future, and they don't need to prove it true or false, right?
Yeah.
So I believe, and this happens oftentimes, right? People, the people who have been pushing forward the state of the art in AI are like deeply smart mathematicians and people who really understand linear algebra and are able to come up with new ways of helping computers do things. They're not necessarily that expertise doesn't necessarily translate to like predicting the future of how society is going to shift from AI, right? You could be very good at building AI. I actually don't think that gives you much credibility around what the future of society is going to look like with that AI, like by the nature of your AI expertise. And so that's just my thought on some of these people who think that, you know, the end is near because computers would get so smart so quickly. And there's no path right now to think that's going to happen. Like right now, anybody can go on ChatGPT. What ChatGPT is doing, it's essentially, again, it's predicting what would the average person on the internet respond to the prompt that I just gave it. There is so much of a gap between that and being smarter than everybody who ever lived that, and as of right now, there's no evidence that we have any path under the technology perspective to get there. And what it sort of takes me back, and from the insurance industry, I'm sure many people here will relate, like when automatic driving cars were a year away 7 or 8 years ago, and everybody knew that it was only a matter of time. And the CEO of Uber came on the Tonight Show and he got asked, well, aren't you trying to get rid of all your drivers? And they said, well, yeah, but at least for the next year or two, they're going to be necessary. Uber drivers are not going anywhere. The human drivers are not going anywhere. The systems that are able to do some automatic driving, they've come a long way, but they're mostly tracking the lines right between you and the cars. It's not what people thought it was going to be. And the reason is because of, and this will probably get to a more broad use case example, which I'm sure a lot of people in your audience will be interested in. The challenge is that AI models, or ChatGPT is a perfect example, but even if you could get higher than that from an accuracy perspective, is the average answer on the internet to your question good enough for your use case, right? And maybe it is 90% of the time, but what about that 10% of the time? What does that mean for your business? And if one out of every 10 answers was not just wrong, but totally made up. And that's where a model like ChatGPT will not necessarily be able to do all of the things that it can almost do. Right. So you look at it and you say, oh, this can kind of get close to coming up with LinkedIn ideas. Like maybe it can come up with 10 ideas and one of them is pretty good and you choose that one. But you could never let it just go independently post on your LinkedIn because it would look like a total mess.
Right. So many questions. Let me try to hone it down. So maybe to bring it to more business context in general, not even specific to insurance, but we can get closer to insurance as we talk. What are some of the best use cases that you see data and analytics and by extension AI delivering in the business world?
I mean, to me, I see data as an important part of any decision you're going to make in business. Now, as a data person and someone who's led a business and been responsible for P&L, I think like all business people, you have to look at the data and then you have to understand the limitations of that data. And because there are some things that the data is not going to show you, but that are still important to your business. And you can't necessarily automatically look at data and then ignore anything else. Like there's other things that are data is backwards looking oftentimes, right? Doesn't necessarily tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. Sometimes it does, but it's important. It's important to be a part of the fabric of your decision-making process inside your company, because just you know, you can go very far off the rails if you don't actually know where the rails are, right? And where you are in relation to them. So I think data for business is crucial, and data needs to play a central role in any business. When it comes to AI, I see it more as, what are you doing that can be okay? What are you doing that could theoretically be scaled with the benefit of AI, that also can survive the limitations of what AI is not going to be able to give you? And so I'll give a perfect example, because to me, the most important thing about any AI model is what happens if it is wrong. So when I was at Nielsen, we had a division of Nielsen called Grace Note Sports. And what they would do is they would make medal predictions for the Olympics. And so you could see, oh, well, based on all of the athletes' historical performances and where they are in their seasons and everything, you know, here's how many medals we expect from all the different countries. And it was great, right? A lot of news agencies picked it up and people would track it and track versus expectations. But everybody knew that it was going to be wrong. Everybody knew the excitement was not, the model knew everything. The excitement was that it was useful, but that the real world would happen, right? So it was fine if it was wrong. On the other hand, the example that we talked about before with self-driving cars, when it's wrong, that's very bad for people. And the consequence of it being wrong, even if it's not wrong 99% of the time, I mean, if you were not wrong, if you didn't get into an accident 99% of the time when you drove a mile and you had a, you know, hour long commute, you'd get into like an accident or two a week. Right. So there are some cases where 99% of the time doesn't cut it. And so that's where the opportunities are. Do you have something that you can scale with AI that you can manage the wrongness?
You're bringing in risk to it. Now we get a little closer to, you know, insurance speak. I like that a lot, because I mean, I can think of use cases where if there's a mistake in a customer service interaction where, let's say, a customer is told that, I'm making this up, you know, an appointment, they're scheduled to go see their doctor at 2 p.m. And in actuality, the appointment's at 2:30. It's like, okay, they're half an hour off. Like, okay, I think they could live with that. But if you have an AI model viewing a radiology photograph looking for a tumor and it's wrong, like, there the consequences are far more grave. Or, you know, as a lawyer myself, there's a lot of talk in the legal industry like, oh, there's going to be ChatGPT is going to take over the legal profession. It's going to write its own briefs. It's going to be able to analyze script from testimony and know when to object better. Or it's going to come up with novel arguments if it's wrong. And I guess in AI speak, they refer to it as hallucinating. I guess that's the word, where it just makes something up. And the data is so, I mean, the processes going on to how it got there are so complicated, you can't even find the root cause of why it gave that wrong answer. Like, there's real risk there. So I can think in terms like that, and I get it. So I guess this leads to my question, like, is it really going to replace human decision making, or is it going to just replace those functions that are super repetitive and administrative and that could otherwise be done by a model that aren't really that risky?
Yeah, so I think that there will certainly be some jobs that it replaces, and there will be other jobs that it creates, like any technology. I was talking to a friend the other day, actually, and we were talking through this. You know, a lot of the jobs that, at least in the shortest term, AI is going to replace have probably mostly been outsourced by now, because it's like the people who were writing, you know, SEO blog posts, low quality SEO blog posts with a agency operating overseas, for $1 a post. Now they can, and they weren't getting back quality posts, but they just wanted to scale it because of volume of keywords. Can they get something similar-ish with AI? Yes. And will a lot of those things fall away? Yes. There are some specific search use cases that are sort of closer as well. So for example, Stack Overflow, which is a very well-known programming site. So because OpenAI scraped Stack Overflow, they have every answer for every programming question that's been asked in the last couple of years online. And so they have their own internal, you ask it a question, it gives you what it thinks the answer is. Now, again, because of the fact that it's just sort of, it doesn't know anything about programming. It's just always predicting the next word. And so if you give it a math problem, that's why it can give you just totally astronomically wrong answers, because it's like, does this look like a math problem answer? Yes. Okay, good. It doesn't know anything about the content. All it can judge is my response. Does that look like a good answer to this question? But it doesn't know anything about the content.
That's scary. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Wow.
Correct. So that's why if you ask it like chess moves, it will be very good at some common openings, because those openings are repeated and repeated. But then it starts to tell you to do illegal moves, or it tells you to do things that are obviously wrong, because it doesn't know anything about chess. All it knows is, oh, somewhere on the internet, someone said move knight to this square, and it looks like I would put a phrase like that in this type of answer. So sure, go ahead, even though it's impossible. And everybody should go there yourself and go try doing some like calculations in ChatGPT, right? Like, it'll give you the right answer for what's 2 times 2. But if you start typing in random numbers and multiplying them, it's going to give you total gibberish.
That's wild. You figured that would be the easy stuff for it, but the way you explain it, I could see why it would hallucinate effectively.
Exactly, because it's just doing word prediction. So in the legal sphere, and this was there was some articles going around for this recently. It just totally made up cases.
I read the
made
same
up cases.
Thing.
It made up the supporting evidence. It made up the judges' rulings. It made up the names of the judges. It made up everything, but it looked like. Exactly like a case should look. It looked exactly like all of the other things that it read. From a style perspective, it was the same. It was just the substance that was the problem.
Yeah, it was completely fictitious. It had no grounding in reality. They weren't real cases. And that there's talk of malpractice on the part of the lawyer that leveraged ChatGPT to write that brief. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a super philosophical question, but one I want to ask. And as someone, my background is in performing arts. I was a musician before I went to law school. But I think one of the areas of humanity that like makes us human is that we have things like visual arts and literature and music and all these rich things that are a little esoteric and hard to pin down. They're more in the philosophical realm when you start describing them. But it's like, what makes us people? And I was playing around with OpenAI, and they had this DALL-E module where you could give it a prompt, and it would, you know, you could write like, draw me a picture of a cactus in the style of Van Gogh, and it would do it pretty accurately. Some would be kind of funky, but some would get it stylistically pretty right. And then you saw this issue with the Screen Actors Guild where they're afraid that, you know, these large language models are going to replace creative, you know, writing like screenplays and movie scripts and things like that. And I've even seen it in the area of music. And in music, it's been actually around for a way longer time, like sampling. I'd just be curious to, you know, what your thoughts are as someone in this space, been there a long time. Like, what do you think about you know, literature and art and music and things like that, and what role it plays vis-a-vis just humanity?
Sure. That's a big question.
And it's a big one. This is one of those three-hour conversations.
Yeah, this is one of those where, in the same way that I said before, that just because you're good at math doesn't mean that you can necessarily predict social things. I will give my own personal opinion on this, but I don't think that my opinion in this area is any more or less valid than anyone else. This is just my own personal opinion on it. I think that the different areas that you talked about have different challenges. I think the writing side of it, I'm not concerned at all, especially the Screen Actors Guild stuff that they're doing. I mean, as it is right now, so you have many, many human writers who would very gladly write screenplays for the amount of money that people make for screenplays. And there is no AI out there that can get even close to the level of those people who are not in that union, who are not able to do it. And so I don't think AI is going to take anyone's jobs there. In fact, AI is probably going to make people's jobs easier, because one thing that AI is good at is sort of divergent idea generation, right? Tell me 30 things that I might do with this script, or tell me 10 things that this character might do that would be interesting based on what you've read of the script so far. And maybe I, as a writer, might have thought of one or two of them, but there'll be a couple there and there'll be a lot of garbage, but there'll be one or two that will be interesting and will spark people's creativity. But ultimately, it's going to be up to that individual writer what to choose. And as a result, it's going to be a human end product. I don't see that we're on any path at least based on the technology as it is right now. At any point, the technology could get substantially better, but at least where the technology is right now, there doesn't seem to be a path to replace like a script writer for a television show or a movie. Music, I think for music, as you said, there have been kind of sampling, electronic music creation opportunities and around for a while. And I think it's definitely influenced the industry, but I don't think, again, it's taken away the human creativity side of it. And again, there are so many people putting out music right now that are not that are not popular and can't get their music popular. I don't see it replacing people. You might have more noise. And I think there are certain genres of music that, I mean, already were heavily computerized.
Yeah, relied on like, it. Yeah, part of the genre itself.
Exactly. Or like even the like I listen to some deep focus playlist on Spotify that's kind of like background electronic music when I just want to focus and do work. Those kind of things are probably more repeatable, but anyways. So that's music. The art piece, I think that I don't have a great answer for that. Art is already such a strange industry right now, where the people who make a lot of money for art, whether it's commercially or popular art, they're so specialized in what they do, and they've been able to market it effectively and all this other stuff. I think I don't see it necessarily changing that dynamic. I do think like stock images and certain elements of those markets are going to change substantially, but the overall market, I don't see it replacing humans. I think where the biggest challenge is going to be is around the sort of ownership of yourself in sort of artistic medium or form, or what, I don't know how to best say it, but like if I could make myself look exactly like a popular actor and sound like a popular actor, what does that mean? And what are the implications of that? Does that person own the fact that they look like them and sound like them on a screen? Right. Or like if I wanted to emulate Sean, right? Yep. And scary. I wanted to look like you and sound like you, do you own that, or am I able to do that? That, I think, is going to be the first big big question.
Well, that was another, I mean, yeah, you get start thinking about intellectual property and like image and likeness. And that was another, I think, beef that some of the SAG folks had, is that they would appear in a movie as an extra and they would sign over their image and likeness in that movie, but then they would replicate it and put them in another movie and they wouldn't be compensated for it. That's a fascinating, yeah, that starts getting a little scary. And I don't have an answer for that, how that will play out probably in the courts.
Yeah.
All right. I fully knew that I would be a little all over the place with my questions just because they would come up as I found them interesting. And I guess to sort of dip back into the business realm, I'm also, and it sparked it because of a few things you said, and I think it's really important and it's not part of the conversation. Like somehow when we talk about AI, we talk about almost like this machine just making decisions on its own without any type of human interaction or interface. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. And I appreciate you. You said it several times. You said decision-making and that's how it's used. And I see that that is where it's powerful. So along with that, I'm thinking about one of the biggest decisions you have in a business is recruiting and hiring people. And we're learning every day as we read these articles, like there have been algorithms in place for a long time to screen candidates and screen text within resumes. And where do you see the efficacy of AI in recruiting and hiring talent? And where is the line that you would draw to say like, no, at this point, this is where a human needs to come in and say, no, there needs to be people like actually evaluating candidates.
So this one, I think, as you said, there have for many years been algorithms that ranked candidates inside applicant tracking systems. And so I don't see generative AI and the new AI innovations that have happened as substantially changing the hiring process. And so I don't see that like ChatGPT will do that much. Now, maybe at some point ChatGPT will be able to conduct sort of text interviews and people can go back and forth with responses. I don't see that as substantially different than people having to fill out questionnaires, answering questions during the interview process, maybe slightly more interactive, but I don't think it's like a step change from the existing process. I also think that in general, companies that care about talent understand the need to have a good process to find and recruit and hire that talent. And so, and ultimately, at least this is my point of view, you know, talent is the most important thing in your business. And so you can do some filtering within resumes to take disqualified people who obviously, if you have a lot of resumes come in for a specific position, sure, being able to filter out the top half from the bottom half, given a certain set of criteria there, is helpful from an operational perspective. And definitely sometimes you'll have false negatives in that group that you've filtered out, but I think that's reasonable.
Yeah.
So I don't see that as bad, but I don't see it as something you can really outsource unless you really don't care about your talent, in which case I think your business is doomed anyways in the long run.
Exactly. Getting maybe into insurance a little bit, especially in workers' compensation and claims, there's been a big push towards a more hands-on approach, a more empathetic approach dealing with the human being on the other side of the claim, the person who got injured. And I think a concern with leveraging data and analytics, and especially AI is that somehow the insurance industry is going to take a step backwards and not deliver this, lose the human touch and lose empathy or this claimant-centered approach is sometimes it's called. And I mean, I personally see an opportunity to streamline and automate a lot of the manual processes that take a claims examiner away from interacting with a person, like using that hopefully as an assistive aid in making better decisions for someone to get them either healthier sooner or get them treatment that's more effective or lessen quicken the healing curve. Knowing your deep domain expertise, Solomon, is in data analytics and AI and this stuff, not being an insurance expert, but knowing probably a little bit about the industry, like where do you see data and analytics and AI transforming or helping folks in the insurance space? And obviously there's stuff probably on the underwriting side, highly technical, like math stuff that I think it will help, but what are some of your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, realistically, I think there's going to be a bit of both sides of what you talked about. I think in many cases, there will be companies that try to deal with the downsides of automation while saving costs. But on the other side, I think you'll also have companies that are using data and analytics to provide a better experience. I mean, I imagine that there is a lot of manual work that takes effort on both sides, from the customer side as well as the insurance company side, that everybody would be a better experience for both parties if that could be done in a more effective way, informed by data or just done. And some of this is just straight up digital transformation. It's not necessarily data and analytics.
100%. It's actually getting into the 21st century, or yeah, sometimes even the later half of the 20th century. Yep. 100%.
Exactly. So from that perspective, I think anybody who says it's going to be one or the other is wrong. It is going to be both. I personally think that net, it's going to be a better experience, because I think in the long run, those better, and again, I'm not an expert in insurance, and so I'm sure there are going to be some cases where this is not true, but in general, the better experience wins and the better product wins over a long enough period of time. And if you can show how what you're doing, informed by data, driven by data, is providing a better service and at a reasonable price, then I think that that's a benefit. So
100%. I don't know if you've heard of the company Lemonade. They started in New York City. They started just doing rental property claims. I think they even do pet insurance now. And I believe that they've expanded into other jurisdictions, but you could file a claim and get paid in minutes. Their customer service rocks. And, yeah, I agree with you 100%. If you can leverage it in such a way to make the customer service experience better, you're going to have people buying your product. And I think in the case of workers' compensation, if you can find ways to free up a claims examiner to give a level of, concierge service that an injured party has never gotten, you're going to find people getting better a lot quicker. Reducing your legal fees significantly in the process. I guess another question to throw at you is, it's a big question, and sorry that it's so general, but in cases where you've been responsible for a business unit or you've consulted with companies, what are areas in general that you see companies having blind spots with respect to their own data and leveraging that
I mean, every company has blind spots with respect to their own data and leveraging it. So there's a lot of people out there who talk a big game at industry conferences or in their marketing materials. And everybody knows that this is not easy work. It's not like you decide one day, I want to incorporate more data or I want to be more data driven. And then the next day it's done. Right. So now what I find is that the best way of executing some of these transformations or these initiatives is like impact by impact along the way, as opposed to massive effort, hopefully with some impact at the end of a couple of years. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of, everybody knows it's not like a automatic thing when you just want it to happen. But what you do over time is you slowly build out infrastructure, slowly build out capabilities and make things better little by little. And then suddenly at the end of that journey, you're in a much better place.
This conversation has been awesome, Solomon. I've learned a lot. Just based upon like hearing me ask myself questions out loud, I have a long ways to go on my journey and learning about data and analytics and AI. But I think you definitely opened my mind up to a lot of what's going on behind some of these concepts that we've sort of popularized in little blog pieces that I think is not, it does the technology a disservice, frankly, when we pop culturize these things that are incredibly complex. And we could spend another 3 or 4 hours talking about them, but maybe we will. I'd love to have you back on the podcast. I just incredibly appreciate the time and the conversation. This was probably the most fun I've had on a podcast in a long time.
All right.
And learning as I'm talking to you. So I appreciate it, Solomon, very much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Sean. Thank you so much for having me. And happy to come back anytime.
Well, thanks, Solomon.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of It's Settled, the Ametros podcast. For more information and episodes, you can visit us at our website at ametros.com. That's ametros.com. Or head over to iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to sharing more stories of people overcoming their workplace accidents and bodily injury claims and those who are working hard to make a difference for them. So it's settled. We'll see you next time.